I want to get a little audience participation here for a minute. I'm just kind of curious to know the extent to which you believe you are very aware of, familiar with, how our let's just take Anchorage, students in Anchorage, biracial and ethnic subgroups are doing academically. Please raise your hand if you feel like you know very well. Hi, so I can really see. Okay, so I would say it's about 10 to 20% maybe, which about of the people in the room. And I appreciated, Diane, just that you said that you do know of some groups that are really trying to look at this and trying to address it. Okay. The thing I'd like to kind of go to next, we've touched on it a little bit. Talking about the American school system, you know, the assertion is that students coming in with two strikes against them should be provided with the best schools, the best teachers, but this is not what happens, according to Mr. Tilson. Thus, a third strike happens. He calls this the dirty little secret of American education, that low-income minority students are far more likely to have low-performing teachers, less experienced, went to less competitive colleges, did not major in subjects they were teaching, had lower ACT scores, et cetera. What information can any of the panelists share that either dispute or support that claim, especially in Alaska? Celeste.
I can't speak to that, but I sure would love to hear the response.
I can definitely say that in our rural and remote schools, we do tend to have the youngest, least experienced teachers with high teacher turnover. I'm not going to say that these are the least effective teachers. I'm going to say these are the least supported teachers in many cases. We have a statewide teacher mentoring program. It provides them a mentor who can get out there in person maybe once a month, talk to them on the phone. We do not have really deep, systematic mentoring and induction, and we also have a lot of disconnect between schools and community, and a lot of disconnect in terms of administrative support for those teachers that are struggling. And so it's, you know, rather than saying these are bad teachers, these are teachers placed into a situation that they're not prepared for, and then we're not figuring out what we do next to make sure they can succeed.
Yeah, as teachers, we recognize that there are schools where there are weaker teachers, and we would love to do something about it. Alaska's unique. It's not the same as an inner city situation. Our most prime example is probably the rural area where, as Diane said, teacher turnover is very high, and it's been that way for a long time. The living conditions in rural areas are very challenging, and it's challenging to keep teachers there. I was just talking to a student from St. Paul yesterday, and she happened to be flying on the same plane I was, and she said that's the problem, that the teachers don't stay. And she was training to become a teacher, and she was very excited that she was going to be hopefully the first teacher in St. Paul that actually got to stay there, which is really important. Teachers should be grounded in communities, and the best communities have teachers that stay there and work for 10, 20, 30 years in potentially the same school and the same community. So we're definitely for, like Diane said, as teachers, we want to be better. We want to make great educators all the time. You got to take people where they are. Some people are better than others at the get-go. But with some dedication and hard work, almost everyone can get better and move up the scale, and that's what we have to do.
Another quick little audience participation piece. I'm curious to know your perception on this question. So, audience, please raise your hand if you agreed with Tilson's assertion that low-income minority students are far more likely to have quote-unquote low-performing teachers. Please raise your hand high if you agree with that assertion. Interesting, because it's a majority. I'm also curious to know, in the audience today, and panelists included, please raise your hand if you have ever been or are currently a K-12 licensed certified teacher. Okay, about a third. It's always just interesting to know who's in the audience. Okay, next question. On this topic of evaluating teacher effectiveness, I think this is a fascinating thing. The documentary asserts that the probably maybe the best measure, according to the documentary, is that did the students learn, which is actually something that's under debate in Alaska right now. But the documentary says this is hard data to get, so they focus on inputs instead. They focus on, did the teacher have emergency certification? Actually, I might have watched the long version and you the short version, but anyway. Did the teacher go to a competitive or a non-selective college? Does the teacher have at least 4 years of teaching experience? Did the teacher fail the basic skills test on the first attempt? And what were the ACT or SAT scores? So I was curious to hear from the panelists. In your opinion, would inputs such as these five be reasonable measures most of the time of teacher effectiveness or not? And how in Alaska are we currently measuring teacher effectiveness?
I would have no idea without some serious data and knowing what data went into that analysis that he gave us. I would have no idea whether those are good indicators or not.
If those would be good inputs to
inputs, yeah, okay, no idea.
Sure.
Tim has an opinion.
I have an opinion. Actually, those aren't half bad, but they're very minimal standards. To meet those standards, I would hope every teacher met at least those standards. And if we can meet those, then we can start moving up the ladder. To me, they're fairly basic. The next step, the second part of your question was, what is our current evaluation system in the state? And we have gone through a shift. Remember, this film was produced in 2010, and that was right at the beginning of Race to the Top. And part of the Race to the Top program, which has affected Alaska, as along with every other state, is to require a new evaluation system for teachers to be created. And we are at that point right now where we're pretty much ready to implement, I think, in every district next year, a new evaluation system. The largest districts in the state are going to be using what's known as the Charlotte Danielson evaluation system. It's a system I'm very familiar with. I've studied it a lot, and I think it has a lot of merit to it. It's a lot more rigorous than the five that we just saw on the film. It really quantifies what good teaching looks like in a classroom, and it is truly really hard to measure student learning in a classroom. It comes in so many different ways. One test on one day in English or math doesn't give a very good picture. Student learning is a tough one to measure, but I think as a teacher, every day I judge myself on that. When I walked out of class today at 2:15, I thought to myself, how much student learning has happened in my class today? And, you know, we were studying To Kill a Mockingbird, great book, had some great discussions. Did I get everything I could possibly out of it? You know, those are the type of thoughts that go on as a teacher on a daily basis.
Thanks. A little bit more audience participation. Audience, please raise your hand high if you have ever had a teacher that stands out as really helping you learn, who really prepared you to be successful. Please raise your hand if yes to that. Wow, I see a couple people that did not raise, almost everybody did, but a couple people didn't. Now, please raise your hand if you ever had a teacher that really didn't help you learn much at all. Same results.
Yeah.
Interesting, right? Okay, last question. Please raise your hand if your perception is that our public school system is good at keeping and rewarding the most effective teachers and releasing ineffective teachers.
Yeah, it's a two.
Do you want me to ask it again?
Actually, I'd like to maybe comment on that.
Okay, go ahead.
We're in the middle of a study on teacher tenure. And please, if you'd like to, we have a survey we need community members to take. But one of the things that Alaska differs from New York on is we don't have a tenure system that keeps people in the rubber room because they can't be dismissed if they are ineffective. We actually, if principals do their job, and document teachers who are not doing their job, teachers are dismissed. And that is different. I took a class from the longest lasting superintendent in LA Unified history, and he, in LA Unified, said they fired 11 teachers in 7 years. That's the second largest school district in the country. It's not the situation in Alaska. Our tenure system is due process, but it is not undue barriers to dismissing ineffective teachers. And so I think that is very different.
Jill.
Can I do a quick follow-up question? How many Anchorage School District teachers were let go last year or fired?
If you ask me that in about a month, I'll have
okay.
all that data.
I'll
We're
ask
in the
you
middle
again,
of getting
but...
it.
Okay. This is going to be the last question before audience questions, but then I'm going to try to reserve a few minutes for the panelists to make a closing statement. So, but this is your last question before we go to them. I wanted to take a little bit of a look at this, a closer look still on this topic of effective teachers. The documentary says that the teacher pool is declining. And it states that those who enter the teaching pool have lower SAT scores and college grades than in decades past, and that far fewer students even major in education anymore, about half fewer than 40 years ago. The rationale that Tilson gives is that we discourage the best students to pursue the field because higher education schools of education are quote-unquote abysmal, the system can't reward superstars, and the system can't get rid of, quote, bad teachers. So what are your thoughts? Is he right that the teacher pool is declining? Is he right that the candidates are less qualified? Are his reasons accurate, inaccurate? And is he missing any important factors for why more students might not enter this profession? Celeste.
Let me just respond quickly to that. You know, I've never been a teacher. I'm not a teacher. But I know that teachers have an awful lot of work ahead of them with students because students are very diverse. I mean, and to expect anyone to want to be a teacher. I know there's a love of for kids and studies and those kind of things, but that's, in my opinion, a task that I would not undertake. There's just no way. And the amount of money, you know, I'm just saying, it just doesn't balance out. My love for kids, yes, but all that goes with that and the responsibility, there's no way. I'm sorry. Mm-mm, not me.
Jill.
As another non-teacher, I can't imagine teaching. That's got to be the absolute hardest. Teaching well has got to be the hardest job in the entire world. I think that they are severely underpaid given the challenges, the constant, every day, every moment, having to figure out what every student needs. If that's the standard that we're going to hold teachers to, which I think we should, we need to compensate them adequately. And I don't think we're anywhere close to that. If you look at what teachers receive, they have a bachelor's. Compared to other bachelor recipients, I think they're way underpaid. But then at the same time, then they have to be held accountable.
So just to add, yes, then first of all, there's an enormous drop happening in the number of people going into teaching. I believe the latest I saw was about a 50% drop entering teacher education programs in California. We're about to hit a crisis. Salaries, the working conditions, mm-hmm. the lack of respect mm-hmm. that teachers receive. When people talk about Finland, why can't we do what Finland did? Mm-hmm. They pay, they respect, it's an honored profession. We did a study of UAA graduates recently. 2-year associate's degree in process technology students after 5 years are earning over $100,000 a year. Students who have a bachelor's degree in education and are tenured working in our schools are earning about half that. So what does this say in terms of what we're valuing in terms of our graduates and what they're doing?
Even back in 1980, when I graduated from college, the phrase was, those who can do, those who can't teach. Remember that? even back then. Okay, we do have a few minutes. I'd like to hear if there are some questions. I'd like to reserve about between 5 and 8 minutes for closing statements, but if you have a question, I have a mic here, and I have a mic here. And I think I see a couple people walking over. Okay, here we go. I had pointed to this side first, so we'll go with the young woman. Thank you.
We've been talking a lot about Alaska policy, but I just was wondering if you can comment on some of the opportunities that we have at the national level right now. We know that President Obama has introduced pretty progressive opportunity to invest in early childhood, both in child care and Head Start, and also in pretty progressive community college reform, and also just with Congress looking at K-12 education reform and revising No Child Left Behind. I just wondered if you could comment on where you see the greatest opportunity now at a national level that can positively impact us.
Hi, Stephanie. I didn't see it, realize it was you. Who are you directing the question to? Okay.
Well, I think I have to unfortunately speak to the state context with early childhood education, which is that right now the legislature is proposing to disinvest. And there's almost no clearer evidence out there in education than that early childhood education is where you can make an enormous difference in the outcomes of children down the road. And so that disinvestment here is happening, and I understand we have a horrible fiscal situation. We were just talking about our furloughs at this university. That said, I think we all agree that we've got to invest in our youngest. Some of the other opportunities, we don't know how, there's no money proposed to support the two-year college initiative. So we sit here looking at the $21 million at this point shortfall that we're facing at our university, and we can't see how we would scholarship all of our two-year students, except that the Alaska Performance Scholarship helps, but not for those people who are underprepared. It helps those kids who are the most prepared.
Yeah. Thank you, Diane. And Stephanie, thank you. To reiterate for those that are going to question next, please follow Stephanie's model, which was to frame your question and ask a question in a very concise way so that we get the maximum possible that can ask questions. Over here.
Good evening. Thank you for a great movie and a great presentation as well. I enjoyed it. And I have to say that for Jill on the end there, I also sat in the hallway with three kids that couldn't read. For a whole year, I volunteered for half a day in my child's class. And I never thought about it. Kids. And I want to thank all the teachers here. You have an extremely difficult job in today's society. I, for one, cannot be a teacher, but there's one person in here at least that had a more difficult job, and that's Celeste, Sue's parent. And with that being said, under No Child Left Behind, Anchorage Schools, about 2 years ago, we had 13 neighborhood schools that failed No Child Left Behind for 3 years or more. And under the law, the state law and the federal law, the state was required and the district were required to put their best teachers, quote, most effective, in those schools that failed No Child Left Behind. Now, it appears as if that hadn't been done. And I was wondering why. I have two questions. I think we'll all agree that the best way to educate a child or give them the best opportunity is to have an effective teacher in every classroom. Mm-hmm. There's an organization called the National Council for Teacher Quality. You're probably aware of some of you probably aware of it. They just came out with a study in Alaska. The teacher stats in Alaska, education-wise, preparing students to teach in the classroom, got an F. Second from the bottom, only outdistancing Montana. So my question to you is, how do we fix this? How do we prepare student teachers to teach better in the classroom?
Thank you. That's a great question, and we won't get the whole answer, but who wants to take a stab?
I can't. Come on. That goes right along with my same theory, and I think the theory of most teachers is to make every educator a great educator. We definitely need to do that, and the best ways to do that, and actually Diane said one of them earlier, is mentor programs. We have to find ways for young teachers to spend more time with other quality mentors who can continue their training. We put teachers through a one-year induction program, and at the end of 1 year, they might not be completely ready to go. And Diane also mentioned Finland, which seems to do it a lot better, where they go through a master's degree program. It takes them 3, sometimes 4 years to get to the point where they're finally ready to tackle their own classroom. We have a system where we rush teachers in a very quick way. It's kind of a either you fly or you die kind of system. And within 5 years, 50% of all teachers have left the classroom. And a lot of it, I think, is because of the reasons that we heard down here, which is it's really hard. The working conditions are really hard. I'm not supported. And I get in one classroom and nobody ever comes and sees me or supports me or talks to me about my learning and helps make it better. We need time to do some of those things, and we really need to give some supports to our young teachers.
And if I can just briefly also say, NCTQ, when you look at the literature basis for what they talk about, there's very good literature. When you look at what they actually do in terms of assessing programs and states, they get it really wrong to the point where they've attributed data to programs that don't exist in our universities. They've missed programs that do exist. And so we have an unfortunate situation where again, if you look at the literature they cite, it's the right literature. If you look at the practice of assessing states and schools, they get it wrong, and we don't understand why.
Thank you, Diane. And thank you for the great questions and comments.
One hypothetical. What would any of the panelists do if you were a single parent and low income and your child were in the classroom with a defective teacher? What would you do?
I'll take that. Because I did experience that. And what I did, I lived in an area that had teachers. Well, again, I don't want to offend, but you know, the school wasn't going the direction I wanted them to go with my child. So, but my parents lived off Huffman, South Side. I lived East Side. So my daughter lived with my mother through the week and went to school where she could, you know the rest of the story?
Yep, you worked the system. And
I worked
you
the
got
system.
What you needed for,
and
you,
I did
for your
get
daughter.
What I needed. And they both my girls graduated from UAA, so I'm not ashamed.
Thank you. We need to move to the next question. Sir?
Thank you. A couple of thoughts. First thought is I'm glad you didn't get arrested and put in jail, because there are some parents that have done exactly what you've done in one in particular, I think, about in Newark. And because they gamed the system, they were arrested and spent time in jail. So I'm glad you did what you did for your kids, and I'm glad you didn't go to jail.
So am I.
I also want to recognize that of about 40 people in the room tonight, about half appear to be younger people or students. And so I just wanted to thank the students for coming tonight and for the World Affairs Council for putting this presentation on. The academic achievement gap in the Anchorage School District over the last 10 years since we started tracking achievement gaps in 2005-2006 has either been flat or got wider, while at the same time proficiency has been relatively flat. It appears that there's schools of excellence, classrooms of excellence, organizations of excellence like First Alaskan, Cook Inlet Tribal Council, and others. My question is, how do you believe that, or do you believe that it's time for a educational revolution in Anchorage, discussed by Assemblyman Bill Starr last night at the Assembly meeting? And if you do believe that it's time to greatly improve educational outcomes. How would you propose that we do that, Nancy? And who would be the leading organization to start that movement?
Who would like to take the question?
I don't know this. I don't know about this revolution, this or this person.
Wow, it's funny because I actually am thinking. I've been thinking about that much more in terms of the rural context because of the conversation I had this morning. Which one of the things that we see when we've looked in asking questions about Indigenous success is a minimum condition is parent and community ownership of schools, a different relationship to the schools. North Slope Borough School District has an initiative called the Inupiaq Learning Framework and the Curriculum Alignment Integration Mapping Project, where they went out to the parents and community and said, what do you want your children to be when they graduate? And then they started developing curriculum to work through that. It's a long process, it's a hard process. They've got federal grants, they've got people working on this. My question here is, how do we create ownership? I think that question about what do you do as a single working low-income parent who probably doesn't have the time to be that involved day in and day out in the school, but how do we create schools where communities own it more? And I think that is one of the pieces. We need, and economics means that it's hard for some parents to be there day in and day out, but what can we do to get their voices in there when they physically can't be there? And I think that's a big piece.
One of the, I know I'm the moderator, but one comment. One of, I think, the false paradigms that we operate under is that we have this triad. It's the teacher, it's the student, and it's the parent or the family, and that's it. And that's not perhaps the right paradigm in which to build the answer. I actually have time for one more question. I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry, just a comment.
Yes.
I didn't hear any answer to my question. But again, even though the panel has decided not to answer my question, it's a very, very big question. And when we start talking about that, we will start affecting a positive change in student outcomes. But again, I really want to thank you for putting on this panel. Hopefully this will begin a broader community conversation. And the World Affairs Council could be a leader in broadening the conversation about how do we improve our schools in Anchorage. But again, thank you very much.
Thank you for the comment, sir. Okay, last question.
Mr. Parker, you're representative of the union.
Yes.
I have never despaired or felt ill feelings for anybody in the teachers' union. We're all in this together. But your broad stroke brush of discrediting Mr. Tilson's assertions, to me is disturbing. I can take you to, we're one of the most diverse cities in the United States. And I can take you on a tour and show you everything that he asserts. We're in this together. He said that number one, you go around and find out why do we have no expectations for poor minority children. Well, first, number one, we blame the children. Number two, we blame the parents. That is pervasive in this community. I'm part of it. I'm part of white privilege. I get to hear this. I can take you, I can show you segregated schools. I can show you segregated schools under one roof, or they have two schools under one roof. I can show the white flight. We're all in this together. Regarding the teachers, there's no lack of outside audits, organizations coming here to look at our district. And I can show you their findings where they have found low expectations for these kids. Everything Mr. Tilson said. Low expectations from our school board members for these kids. It's who we are. We're, I don't know what you call it, racist, xenophobic. We label these kids and we blame them. It's a fact. So One of my questions would be, if you're going to so broadly discredit Mr. Tilson's word, please direct us to the data, because all the data that I've studied a lot, supports what he says, as I experience it and see it evidentially in this school district. And secondly, I really do challenge you to come with me to show you some data. I can show you your books of elementary schools and show you segregation with them. I can take you to show you the teachers that are in segregated schools, that they are of the lower quality. I can point you to teachers that will tell you this very same thing.
Thank you, sir. I didn't hear a strong question. I heard a very clear statement in that, which is a worthy statement, and I'm glad it was. Data. Okay. Do you have anything you can point them to?
Well, I appreciate the question and the thoughts. If you think I'm discrediting him with a broad brush, I don't think that's what I'm doing, but I mean, you're entitled to your opinion. I heard him state probably 1,000 different statistics in the hour-long presentation that we heard, and I don't have time to research each one of them. I have no doubt that what you're saying about schools and segregation exists in this country. I've been around. I've been to other places. I've seen those things, but the idea of low expectations, that teachers in general have low expectations, I reject that. I can tell you in my classroom, in my school, and I think for most of the schools around the state, that's not the case. I have very high expectations for all of my students, regardless of the color of their skin. And we work hard every day as teachers to do the best that we possibly can with the inputs that we have, the different things that are at our disposal. So I guess the statistics are fine. I'm not sure how to provide every refutation to everything that Mr. Tilson said, but I just object to some of his very strong statements in a couple of areas, and I'd be happy to go into more detail, but I think that the big picture is high expectations for kids is probably the most important thing that we should have. And I heard you say in your statement that you think that's low expectations, and that's not the case. It's not the case for me, I can tell you that for sure. I have very high expectations for my students.
To make a segue to our last piece, which is we have just 5 minutes, so it's really 1 minute for each one of you folks. But I would say this, I'd like to commend all of the questions that were asked. Thank you for all the statements and opinions that were shared. And I'd like to build on the last gentleman's statement that wouldn't it be a great place in Anchorage if we all held the very highest expectations for all of our children in this community and did everything we could, whoever we are, in whatever role we have, to ensure that each child succeeds to their maximum potential. So I'm going to actually start with you, Tim, and I'm going to work down to Jill for 1 minute.
Sure. Some closing thoughts. Thank you. This has been a wonderful panel and conference and an opportunity here. So thank you very much for attending tonight. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I'm very excited to have had this chance. I do teach full time. Tomorrow morning I will be at 7:45. I'll be at Lathrop High School teaching in room 239. So I'll be right there doing what I do inside the union. And I love my work with my union. They do really good things. We are very much for, and I've worked with lots of different teachers from across the state, we're very much for making every educator a great educator. If there are ideas that will increase student learning in classrooms, we are for them. We've talked about this in so many panels in so many areas around the state. We get teachers together in groups of hundreds, and they unanimously support the idea of improving student learning. Give us ideas that will improve student learning. A lot of them have to do with incorporating parents. A lot of them have to do with increased professional development and mentoring and good ideas like that. We're for those. There's nothing I want more than to walk out of school at the end of the day feeling successful and feeling like I've made a difference and help kids get to where they want to go. I certainly don't want to be in some of the schools that were sort of referred to in the video as happy places where everyone just goes along to get along. That's not okay with me. I have very high expectations for what goes on in my school, and I work in a school. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Lathrop, but it's a lower income Title I heavy school in Fairbanks, and I love working there, and believe me, I pour my heart into it on a daily basis.
So I am part of a self-study the Anchorage School District is doing, looking at how resources are allocated based on models that say, you know, here are some things that we could be doing differently, whether it's teacher coaching, whether it's restructuring some of the district office positions into more school-based positions. And I got the privilege of visiting a happy school with incredibly high expectations and high achievement. So I don't see happy as being an indicator of poor. But actually, to the gentleman who asked about radical change, yeah, in actually in my other world where I'm in charge, we would radically change the whole system. We would stop thinking about the school day as something between 8 and 3 and within the buildings, and we would eliminate the Iowa farm-based schedule that we have. We might think about in some of our communities that in September kids should be able to go moose hunting, and then we would teach biology on those moose. That in April, instead of forcing all the kids to sit in front of the computers for the standardized test scores, we might let them go out hunting for the first fresh meat that shows up on wings from the goose. And then again, we might have them write stories and do art projects around the geese. I would change everything to base it in the place where we are, as well as meeting those national standards, because I believe we truly can do that. But that's going to take a really powerful set of conversations that involve us all, parents, educators, the university, and the community. And that's, yeah, I'd like to get there.
As former National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, as the former president of the chapter here in Anchorage for nearly a decade, I realize and I recognize that youth of color have had challenges within the educational system here in Alaska for years. I mean, like we've shared already, the stats have been there. It's nothing new. You know, it's time now to work to try to do something about it. And as the executive director of Shiloh Community Development Incorporated, which is a nonprofit organization that empowers youth, minorities, and the disadvantaged, I invite you all to our upcoming conference. And on April the 25th, we're having an educational component piece. And I'd like to continue the dialogue if possible. And, you know, I grew up, my family, there wasn't a discussion about college. So, you know, we didn't learn about, or I didn't hear about these vigorous programs in school and, you know, how to get your rigorous and so that you can get these AP classes and all these other things. I'm just learning about these things. So, you know, our community, I just think that there needs to be more of discussion about college and the opportunities to secure AP classes, and so that you're ready. I mean, and the college readiness and all of that other stuff that didn't occur in my lifetime. That's why, you know, I'm always excited to talk with our youth about preparing for college, and maybe college is not what some youth want to do, but there's definitely something out there where they can be successful too. So,
thank you. I feel somewhat unqualified at this point because I'm talking just as a mom that watched my kids in the public schools for many, many years. And like I said, I spent a lot of years of my life in the public schools watching. I believe there's a huge disparity between teaching quality and what each student receives from their teachers. I'm not surprised about anything in the documentary. It supports what I've seen. At the same time, I don't blame teachers. I think teachers are the source of the problem. The classroom is the problem, and teachers are in the classroom. But it's not because they're bad teachers or bad people. They're not prepared. They're not held accountable. They don't have the tools that they need. And yet this has continued year after year after year. How we fix it, I don't know. But I think we've gone on long enough, and I think it needs to be fixed.
Well, at least we're talking about fixing it, right? So it's a start. Alisa, I'd like to invite her, and while she's coming to close out the ceremonies tonight, just wanted to say that we've covered a lot of challenging ground here tonight, and I want to thank everyone for their insight, their honesty, and reasoned discussion. Alisa?
On behalf of the Alaska World Affairs Council, I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight and to keep these conversations in the community going. Education is definitely a very important issue, whether it's focusing on Anchorage and Alaska or on a global scale. And I want to thank our panelists for the great discussion tonight. And if I could get a round of applause for our great moderator, June, and our four panelists. Thank you very much. And we have lovely little water bottles for them to remember their evening by. And I would love to see you all back here next week on Thursday for Comedy, Economics, and Carbon Tax. It's going to be a bit of a more lighthearted evening. But it'll be the same time frame, 7 o'clock, Wendy Williamson. And you can get more information on our website. And thank you again.